You're listening to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about adopting a plant-based diet, full or part-time. Our goal is to empower you to live a long and healthy life. You can find today's show at ordinaryvegan.net or on iTunes. If you have any questions, please send an email to questions@ordinaryvegan.net.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast. Number 27. Thank you so much for being here and for being part of our health and wellness community. If we haven't met yet, my name is Nancy Montori and I advocate a plant-based diet to keep you as healthy as possible. Not only that, a plant-based diet is good for the environment because it helps reduce gas emissions. It also saves water and saves environmental habitats like tropical rainforests, which are being cleared out to expand agriculture zones around the world. And last but not least, every plant-based meal you consume makes a statement to industry giants that you want animals to be treated humanely. Speaking of animals, today I have a special guest to celebrate World Kindness Week. His name is Nathan Runkle. Nathan is the founder and president of Mercy for Animals. Through his work with Mercy for Animals, Nathan has been an outspoken advocate for animal rights. He has been featured in hundreds of television, radio, and newspaper interviews, and in 2009, at the ripe old age of 25, Nathan became the youngest person ever inducted into the U.S. Animal Rights Hall of Fame. He recently wrote a book called Mercy for Animals, One Man's Quest to Inspire Compassion and Improve the Lives of Farm Animals. His book is a powerful look at animal welfare and factory farming in the United States. I invited Nathan here today not only to share his compassion for animals, but also to ask him some of the questions I received from many of you about the lab-grown meat movement. If you're not familiar with lab-grown meat, which is also called clean meat, it is a technology being spearheaded by Bill Gates, Richard Branson, and a company called Memphis Meats. The Memphis Meat website says their goal is to change the way meat gets to your plate. And they do this by growing meat from animal cells. We will also talk about why farm animals matter and what we can all do to help. So here we go, my interview with Nathan Runkle, founder of Mercy for Animals. Hi, Nathan. Thank you so much for being with us today, and congratulations on your new book, Mercy for Animals, One Man's Quest to Inspire Compassion and Improve the Lives of Farm Animals. Your book is very compelling, and I don't think I have ever encountered anyone like you to be so enlightened at such a young age. And I would like to point out that this is not a book just for animal lovers. It is a book for anybody who wants to learn about leadership and how to make a difference in the world. So thank you so much for being here, Nathan.
Oh, it's my pleasure and my honor, and thank you for the kind words about the book. I appreciate it.
And can we start this conversation by me asking you, how did a small-town farm boy become so enlightened at such an early age?
Well, you know, I was born on a couch in a village of less than 2,000 people. I was slated to be a fifth generation farmer. But, you know, I always had a natural connection and empathy for animals. I was always able to put myself in their place and just for a moment consider what life was like for them and how they perceived the world. And, you know, I had dogs and cats who were really the first animals to teach me that when it comes to having personalities and minds and interests and rich emotional lives, we are not alone. This is something that is shared with all animals. And clearly that is the same for pain and pleasure as well. So it was our dogs and cats that really started to sensitize me to this as a young child. But I tell the story in the book about one little animal that really started to pull the lens back for me, or as I say, sort of pull the layers of the onion back to reveal the hypocrisy that we have of why we call some animals friends and others food. And that little animal was a rat named Caesar, who I rescued from my neighbors who bred rats and mice and guinea pigs and rabbits to be used in experimentation in laboratories. And I named this little guy Caesar, and I was 6 years old. And he would sit on my shoulder, and he knew his name, and he would come running, and he was just so intelligent and curious. But I would bring friends and parents of friends into my room to meet Caesar, and so many of them would shriek in horror and disgust at the sight of a rat. And I realized at this young age that Caesar was being judged for what he was, not who he was, not the individual with a unique personality that I knew him as. So as I said, that started to sort of shift my view of animals away from just dogs and cats.
In your book, you mentioned the connection between being feeling like an outcast and in your connection with animals. Can you speak on that?
Yeah, I talk about sort of a number of points that certainly I think put me in an outsider perspective. I mean, one is I was slow to talk as a child. My parents took me to numerous child psychologists. There were brain scans, IQ tests, everything that was done, and in some ways I was in the so-called superior intelligence category. In other ways, I was in the learning disabled category. And the extremes were so dramatic that one of the doctors who evaluated me actually wrote about me in a book that she called Crossover Children, children who were learning disabled and highly intelligent at the same time. And so I think that, you know, the way in which just my mind works and certainly did work as a child allowed me to relate to and perhaps empathize with animals in a way that that some others didn't. I think another way was growing up gay in a very rural, conservative, judgmental, homophobic environment. I knew what it was like to be bullied and intimidated because of simply who I was and the prejudice that people brought to the table. So, you know, for me, animal protection is a social justice issue, just as LGBT rights is a social justice issue. And I think there are a lot of parallels between othering of animals and those who have power exerting it over those who are weak and vulnerable. So I think that those are a number of other elements that sort of added to my sensitivity to animals that would ultimately lead me down the path to become an animal rights activist.
You were only 15 years old when you started Mercy for Animals. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Can you tell me how you did that? I mean, that is remarkable.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it certainly didn't feel remarkable at the time. It just felt like what needed to happen. Yeah, I became a vegetarian when I was 11 after picking up a brochure on factory farming and reading about the way in which animals are abused and just deciding on the spot that I didn't want to pay people to abuse animals on my behalf. When I was 13, I convinced my parents to drive from our farm in Ohio to Washington, D.C. so I could attend an animal rights conference. But when I was 15, there was a farm animal abuse case at our local high school, which I'll spare the details because it's quite graphic. But it was that animal abuse case, which I talk about in detail in the book, that highlighted to me that there needed to be an organization in my local community that would give a voice to animals that are raised and killed for food, because they don't have the same type of legal protection as dogs and cats do. So when I started the organization, I wasn't even old enough to drive. I had no money, no idea what I was doing. It was really just driven by a passion to help animals. And, you know, the organization was founded 18 years ago now. We operate in 6 countries. We have 130 employees, millions of members, and our work impacts over 1.2 billion animals a year. So we've come a long way, but there wasn't, you know, a magic wand to that success. It was a lot of perseverance and learning, and over time, bringing in and working with just, you know, incredibly intelligent, bright, dedicated people that have helped move the organization forward and make it what it is today.
So how would you answer this question if someone asked you, well, I am asking you, why do farm animals matter?
Well, farm animals matter for the same reason that all animals matter, including dogs and cats, which of course most people absolutely believe matter. And that's because they are unique individuals with rich emotional lives, with minds and curiosity, and of course, the ability to suffer pain and experience joy. You know, these animals are completely at our mercy. We find ourselves in a position where we hold all of the power. And we can use this power to exert cruelty or exploitation upon animals, or we can use it to inspire compassion and help these animals and give them respect. So I believe that how we treat farmed animals is really a moral litmus test for us. And if we can expand our circle of compassion to include animals, then it is a sign of our continued ethical and moral progress.
Can you speak to the contradictory view we have for animals? I mean, we care for the dogs and the cats we have, and why don't people extend their love for other animals? What blocks that?
You know, it really is, in many ways, an arbitrary distinction that we make. And if you look at other parts of the world, for example, you know, cows are largely considered to be sacred in India, and you go to the Philippines or to Korea, and you see that, or even in China places, people are consuming dogs and cats. People are killing dolphins. So the truth is that these animals don't differ in any meaningful way. What differs in a meaningful way is our perception of these animals. Melanie Joy calls this carnism, the invisible belief that allows us to eat certain animals. And the truth is that certainly in the Western world, we really only eat a small number of animal species, and we choose not to eat the others. And I think a lot of this is deeply ingrained through our culture and through our society. Many people don't even really recognize that they are making a choice. We grow up eating turkey for Thanksgiving and hamburgers for the 4th of July. And these animals have become ghosts in our machine, in this situation, our food machine, where people go to the grocery store and they get nicely packaged hamburger or pork, and they are far removed from the individual animals that they are eating.
My next question is the exploitation of animals in industrial farming changing people's views on farm animals?
You know, I think that most people are largely in the dark about how farmed animals are treated. I think that that is starting to change. I think that more and more people understand that factory farming exists and that it is a negative and bad thing, but they don't want to know the details of it. And I call this willful ignorance. But is the way in which they're treated, changing the views of people. I mean, I think that, you know, when these animals are treated as machines and production units and commodities, and the industry portrays that as something that is okay, it certainly is a negative thing for animals. But the truth of the matter is that most Americans do believe that farm animals deserve to be treated well. I mean, this is a bipartisan issue. Polls on a national level show this time and time again. And the reality is that how animals are raised on factory farms are actually far outside the standards that most people find to be acceptable.
In your opinion, what kind of legislation do we need to grant animals rights? And do you ever see that on the horizon? I mean, do you think that will happen in your lifetime?
Yeah, I mean, I'm planning on living well past 100, so we've got some time here, but the animals certainly don't. You know, I think that at the bare minimum, we need to start enacting federal legislation for farm animals that's meaningful. There's currently not a single federal law that provides any protection to animals during their lives on factory farms. And the vast majority of farmed animals, fish and birds, have zero federal protection at the slaughterhouse, which leads to just horrible suffering. Unfortunately, given our current political climate, I don't think that there's any immediate hope for federal legislation to be passed, but we are starting to see changes on a state level, mostly through citizen-driven ballot initiatives that are banning the most intensive confinement systems for farm animals, keeping pigs in gestation crates, hens in battery cages, calves in veal crates, enclosures where they can't even turn around or spread their limbs. And with many of these initiatives, there are now bans on the sale of products, meat or eggs from animals that are kept in similar enclosures. So, you know, I would certainly at the bare minimum immediately like to see federal legislation that does away with the worst forms of a factory farm confinement, giving animals basic freedom of movement. I'd like to see legislation that bans mutilations without pain relief, and that certainly changes the slaughter practices. These are, as I said before, these are things that the majority of Americans already agree on. This isn't a matter of changing public opinion on what should happen. This is simply a matter of bringing laws up to par with where attitudes are. You know, and I believe that one way in which we will address factory farming is through innovation in the food space. And I talk in my book about clean meat or cellular agriculture, literally taking a harmless biopsy from an animal, taking stem cells and growing real meat in a suitable medium. This is meat without the murder. It's far better for the environment, far better for human health. And I think that this type of innovation can essentially do away with factory farming as we move forward. And I think as the alternatives to traditionally raised animal products become more widely available, it will help to tip the scale in a way that will allow real legislation that grant real rights to animals to take center stage.
I know many vegans can't wrap their head around the fact that the clean meat starts with cells taken from live animals. And, you know, what would you say to those people, I mean, who think that wouldn't be vegan?
Yeah. Well, I guess the first thing I would say is vegans don't need to eat clean meat when it comes to the marketplace. It's really something that is geared towards the 98% of people who are not vegan, and many of which have no immediate interest or desire to go vegan. You know, I think that we need to address the issues facing animals on a whole host of levels, some through policy change, education, but also through innovation in the food space. The three primary drivers for food choices are taste, cost, and convenience. And if we can help the space of clean meat and plant-based meat become competitive and, in fact, superior in those three areas of top of cost, taste, and convenience, then I think we enter a time when real dramatic change can happen. So, you know, from everything that I know and that I have seen regarding clean meat, it is superior in the environmental regard. It takes 50% less energy, according to some studies, produces 90% less greenhouse gas emissions, uses 90% less land and water than traditional animal-based agriculture. It doesn't have the same E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter contamination. So I think that it is superior not only in a humane arena, but in so many other areas that are just having vital and important consequences for the planet. But if some vegans are uncomfortable with this, which I understand, I would say continue to eat your veggie burger and, you know, allow clean meat to appeal to the other 98% of the population.
Good point. Well, speaking of food, what do you think about some of these larger vegan companies like Daya Cheese, who was bought by a pharmaceutical company who reportedly does animal testing? Do you think the vegan community should continue to support vegan companies that sell to companies who are not compassionate to animals?
Yeah, you know, this is something that has been going on for quite some time, you know, and I think you could say that companies do animal testing. There are also, you know, meat companies and dairy companies that buy plant-based alternatives. And to me, raising animals on factory farms or animal testing are really in the same category in terms of animal abuse and exploitation. And I think that there are some benefits, actually, when small companies are purchased by large companies that can get them into more stores and give them larger advertising budgets that may be able to mainstream vegan products. And, you know, I think when Silk was purchased or Boca was purchased years ago by large food companies, these vegan products started to appear in Walmarts and gas stations and became far more available for everyday consumers to access them. But I understand the concern. And I think, again, if vegans feel strongly about that, then I understand and respect that decision. But I don't hold the view that it is inherently bad for animals, for larger companies to acquire vegan products, as long as the products themselves remain vegan, and if it gets them more shelf space and more locations and drives down costs to make it more affordable, I think that it actually could be a positive thing in the long run. You know, Tyson Foods, the largest meat company in the U.S., who slaughtered 2 billion animals a year, recently did a 5% investment stake in Beyond Meat. Cargill recently did an investment in Memphis Meats, a premier clean meat company. And I view this as actually a positive thing. And it's because these companies view themselves as protein companies, not meat companies. And as we move forward with plant-based and clean meat, I think that one of the best paths forward to helping the largest number of animals is for these companies not to fight the change, not to try to stifle the plant-based or clean meat market, but in fact to embrace it, to put money into research and development, to include these in their product lines, and hopefully over time eliminate their traditional animal meats in favor of clean meat and plant-based meats. So to me, it's the same with these food companies that are acquiring plant-based milks, et cetera. They are for-profit companies, and they want to do what's profitable. And to have them have these products in their portfolio turns them from being adversarial to the change and puts them into a place of being supportive of it. And I think over time, very well may pave the way for them to move, hopefully, completely in that direction, which, again, I think is a good thing for the accessibility of veganism and for animals.
Can we talk about Mercy for Animals, your organization? I find that some people shy away from animal protection organizations because they perceive them as judgmental. Mm. And can you maybe talk a little bit about how people got that perception And what role does the animal protection movement play in helping us understand the needs of animals without showing videos of animals being mistreated?
Yeah, well, you know, to me, being a vegan advocate is the ultimate expression of love. And I think every time that we sit down to eat, our food choices can be a reflection of our values. And if our values are to be kind and fair and to care about our health and the health of the environment and those who are weak and vulnerable, such as animals, then it really does compel us to move towards a vegan diet. You know, in terms of organizations being judgmental, there are, you know, hundreds and thousands, quite frankly, animal organizations in this country, each run by individuals, each with their own views and philosophies and messaging. So I am certainly not a spokesperson for every animal organization. I can say for Mercy for Animals, we really celebrate positive changes that people make. And, you know, to us, people leaning in towards a plant-based diet, even people starting out by going meatless on Monday, is something that should really be encouraged and celebrating progress over perfection, because progress is something that should be celebrated and really leads to positive changes for animals. You know, Mercy for Animals, we do undercover investigations, and they are graphic and they are disturbing, but they are real, and they pull back the curtain on the very ugly truth about how we abuse animals in our food supply. And it is not something that most people want to look at, and we understand that, but we cannot have a fully functioning, healthy democracy and society if we always refuse to look at what is unpleasant, because it is what is unpleasant that needs our attention most. That being said, it is not the exclusive focus of MFA. These investigations do help drive, you know, incredibly meaningful and impactful legislative work and corporate policy reform work. But a lot of what we do is focused on the how of changing our diets, not just the why. And we have websites such as chooseveg.com. We produce a free veg starter guide. We do tons of just mouth-watering, positive, you know, motivating cooking videos, profile pieces on vegan athletes and owners of vegan restaurants, and videos and campaigns that profile the emotional lives of animals and how intelligent farmed animals are. The fact that chickens can count, that they have a language that's unique to themselves, that they can pass information along from one generation to the next, that cows have best friends and they jump with joy when they have eureka moments, that pigs are more intelligent than dogs. These are things that, you know, we want people to know so that they can see farmed animals as individuals rather than pre-processed goods and food.
In your opinion, how can you teach empathy for all animals to children without showing them, you know, scary videos that show animals being treated inhumanely?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I believe that most children are naturally compassionate towards animals. And is this certainly something that I witnessed growing up on a farm with friends and neighbors who were involved in 4-H programs, raising pigs and calves that would then later be sold for slaughter at the county fair. And these are children who would just pour their hearts into raising these animals. They would bottle feed these animals. They would just do everything they could to give them a good life and protect them. And they would become so attached to these animals. They would give them names, and it would be heartbreaking every year when the fair would roll around and these animals would be sold by the pound at auction and then carted off to the local slaughterhouse. And these children would oftentimes be holding on around the neck of their cows, just not wanting them to go to slaughter, and would just be so distraught by this. And this is, again, this is the norm, but these children would be told, this is just the way that it is. This is what we need to do with animals. We need to eat them. The next year, the same kids would be upset, but they would try to hold their emotions back. And as time would go on, they would become more and more detached and desensitized to the needs of these animals. So I think that having care for animals is our natural default. And I think that cruelty and exploiting them is, in fact, learned behavior. So I think a lot of it is just having good role models, having children that have role models that show that animals are individuals, that they have feelings, that we should treat them with respect, because children really get it. And I think when children can also have conversations about their food and where their food comes from, it doesn't need to be in a way that is graphic, because just children knowing that chicken comes from an actual chicken, if they're taught respect, that oftentimes, and in my experience, is enough for them to really start to view their food in a more meaningful way.
My last question to you is, what could someone out there listening today do to help the animal rights movement?
Oh, this is such a beautiful question. And this is really the way in which I closed the book. And I wrote the book to inspire people to take action on behalf of animals. And I believe that there are just a number of ways. I mean, one is, you can become involved in the political process, as we talked about before. We need real, meaningful laws to grant protection to farmed animals. People can also become effective advocates on social media, and I talk about ways of doing that. People can donate to effective animal organizations. And I know a lot of people say, well, yes, of course, but the truth is that donating to effective organizations can have an incredible impact. For example, every dollar donated to Mercy for Animals allows us to spare one animal from factory farm conditions through diet change campaigns, and will help improve the lives of over 110 animals through legal changes and through corporate policy successes. But I also talk in the book about the need for us all to find our unique talents and skills and determine how we can use our knowledge and our relationships to be effective advocates for animals. And I talk about a vegan race car driver who uses her platform to promote plant-based eating to NASCAR fans. I talk about a former Burger King executive who's seen the light and decided to start a plant-based food company that directly spares animals from suffering by creating better humane alternatives. I talk about a former cattle rancher who turned vegan animal rights activist and uses his unique past and experience to talk about protecting animals. So if you're a teacher, you can teach. If you are an artist, you can use your unique platform to inspire people to act on behalf of animals. If you are a chef, you can show people how delicious and easy plant-based eating is. If you're in the business world, you can earn to give. The options are limitless. And I think that the sweet spot is finding where your passion and where your skills intersect, because diversity is the strength of our movement.
Thank you, Nathan. This has been a great conversation, and I know it will get people thinking about this. And congratulations again on your new book, Mercy for Animals, One Man's Quest to Inspire Compassion and Improve the Lives of Farm Animals. I highly recommend this book as a gift for the holidays. Thank you again for being here, Nathan.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks so much for joining me today. and I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Nathan Runkel. You know, I love hearing from you, so please never hesitate to reach out to me. You can find me at nancy@ordinaryvegan.net. You can find all my podcasts on iTunes or listen right on ordinaryvegan.net. Also, I have redesigned my website, so anyone looking for resources to begin or maintain a plant-based diet, you don't have to look any further. I have vegan shopping lists, protein lists, gluten, soy-free guides, food pyramids, food videos, and hundreds of delicious plant-based recipes. And if you're looking for something special for the holidays, make sure you watch my vegan roast Wellington recipe video on my homepage, ordinaryvegan.net. It is very yummy. Last but not least, always remember, you don't have to be perfect. And if you're suffering from a chronic disease, it's not your fault. I am so proud of you for spending time listening to these health and wellness podcasts and wanting to take back your health. I appreciate all of you so much, and I will be back to serve you in my next podcast. Till next time.
Thanks for joining our plant-based community today. Together, we can accomplish great things. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of Ordinary Vegan's recipes and plant-based tips. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Until next time.